You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, our guest says that Wisconsinites can enjoy the thrill of the hunt without firing a single shot. Instead, we can use a camera and a notebook. We'll learn more about that in a bit.
First, Governor Scott Walker and State Education Superintendent Tony Evers are disagreeing over how Wisconsin should follow a federal education law.
The Department of Public Instruction released a new plan to comply with the Every Student Succeeds Act. Governor Walker says the plan doesn't do enough to turn around failing schools. Evers says the plan had a bipartisan council support and also brings some of the education innovations that Walker was asking for.
Michael Ford is a professor in the Department of Public Administration at UW-Oshkosh. He joins us for a closer look at the disagreement between Evers and Walker over schools. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, you're welcome. Good to be here.
Well, first of all, big picture, what is the Every Student Succeeds Act?
Yeah, well, that is the most current iteration of what was the No Child Left Behind Act prior. So it's the largest federal law dealing with K-12 education in the U.S.
And what's this annual state report supposed to accomplish?
Yeah, the point of this state report is for each state to lay out its plan. The big shift from No Child Left Behind is that rather than having the federal government kind of set the mandates, the idea here is that the state government is best positioned, the state education agency specifically is best positioned to create a plan that can actually improve outcomes.
And is this a significant plan that people do stuff with, or is this kind of a bureaucratic hoop to jump through that gets filed away and is never spoken of again?
You can make the argument both ways on that, but I think it is a significant plan. I mean, it forces state education agencies to articulate their goals, and it forces them to lay out plans for their lowest performing schools. So in that regard, it is a large opportunity.
Now, looking at this Wisconsin's version of this plan for this year, what are some of the main ideas in this report we're talking about?
Yeah, well, I would say that the goals of the plan in particular are bold. So it's laid out in there that they want to cut racial and socioeconomic achievement gaps in half over a six-year period, and that's a very tall task. Mm-hmm. And they do have interventions in the plan for the lowest performing schools in the state, in which they'll bring in external teams to do an evaluation, create school-level improvement plans, and that's no joke. That's serious stuff.
And apart from the racial achievement gap, what other kinds of things are trying to be accomplished here?
Yeah, there's certainly policies in there, ideas in there that are designed to improve teacher quality. But really, the kind of the gist of it is to make sure that the lowest performing schools can close their racial and socioeconomic achievement gaps.
Let's look at the process behind the plan. As I understand it, there's a pretty big committee, long list of names, school administrator groups and school officials, a school choice advocacy group, teachers unions, bipartisan group of lawmakers, and a representative from the governor's office, in addition, of course, to the superintendent of public instruction, Tony Evers. What went into crafting this plan?
Yeah, it's quite a significant process. So they have the group you're referring to is called the Equity Council. And it was created by DPI, and like you said, it had representation across the board. They met seven times over the course of about a one-year period. It might be a little shorter than that. But certainly it was DPI themselves who was in charge of crafting the actual plan, but they were getting feedback from all these different individuals and the organizations they represent along the way. Because the real goal here is buy-in and alignment. For a plan like this to work, people have to be on the same page.
And now we find the governor is not on the same page. He says he's not signing off on this report. He says it's falling short. What are the governor's objections?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of things going on here. First, there are groups and legislators out there who support Walker, that support parental choice policies, and they view DPI as a barrier to improving achievement outcomes in Wisconsin. I think for those folks, really any plan DPI came up with would be deemed insufficient. And then, of course, the obvious, the issue is highly politicized right now by the fact that both Walker and Evers hold a statewide office, and they're both running for governor in 2018. So the governor specifically wants the state to be more, a state education agency to be a little bit bolder, as he stated in his letter. And, obviously DPI disagrees with that.
And the form of that boldness sounds like offering more school choice options. Is that a fair assessment?
I think so. I mean, clearly the governor wants to see macro governance changes in low-performing schools. So what I mean by macro governance is moving struggling schools into a state-run district or some other broad governance entity. But I think it's important to note that the plan is laid out by DPI. It does call for these micro-level governance changes. In other words, changes to the way in which individual schools are run. And that is significant.
We're talking to Michael Ford, professor in the Department of Public Administration at UW-Oshkosh, about a new plan for education in Wisconsin aimed at addressing some gaps, some inequities, a conflict, a bit of a turf war between the Department of Public Instruction and Tony Evers and Governor Walker, and the legislature, too, Mike, as I understand it. There's been talk, at least, of legal challenges saying, you know, the DPI can't set this policy by itself. It has to have the legislature on board. It has to have them weigh in. Is that part of the story here?
Well, it certainly is. I'm not a lawyer, nor do I pretend to be one. But I mean, going back to the Tommy Thompson era, there have been attempts to challenge the independence of the Department of Public Instruction. It's unique, and Wisconsin is a unique state in that regard, that the head of our state education agency is elected as opposed to appointed. Now, that's in the Wisconsin state constitution. So I find it difficult to see a scenario where this does have to go through the legislature, because it does seem pretty within the bounds of authority of DPI.
Well, let's get into the problem that everybody, I think, is trying to solve in their own different ways. We have big achievement gaps in Wisconsin. Often the phrase worst in the nation comes up, especially when talking about achievement gaps among ethnic and racial groups. Can you talk about the problems we face here in the state?
Yeah, they are significant. Those numbers don't lie. Those numbers have been bad, bad for a very long time. And a lot of the things we have attempted to do to close those achievement gaps simply have not been successful. Now, I just published a book on the consequences of governance fragmentation in Milwaukee. Excuse the plug there, but I had to get that in. But in it, I demonstrate the danger of implementing what these bold governance reforms like the governor is calling for. So things like a state-run recovery district or a mayoral takeover. They're built under the idea that magically, you know, just shifting governance structures magically will improve achievement. But without clearly articulated goals, widespread buy-in, and really alignment across these different systems, you'll end up with a situation like we have in Milwaukee, where you have a whole lot of disruption to the status quo, and it came out of a place of, you know, good intentions, because the status quo was unacceptable. But all these changes haven't actually improved student outcomes. Instead, we have this trail of collateral damage. The details matter a great deal. A governance reform is only going to be as good as its ability to create high-performing schools. And I think that there are serious concerns about the capacity for some of the things we've tried in this state to actually do that, because on aggregate, we just have not seen those gaps close to a degree that is necessary.
Let's take a closer look at the Department of Public Instruction plan as it relates to, I think you call it micro interventions in some ways. Instead of changing who's the boss, you know, taking out the school board and shifting it, what kind of things would they do at a difficult school to change the outcomes?
Yeah, they would send in an external team, and they'd be under the management of DPI, who's trained in, as they put it, implementation science. And they are there to really align the curriculum within the school, try to ensure uniform teaching quality across the school, make sure those data systems exist at the school level so that we're actually using test score data, not just for accountability purposes, but actually to inform instruction, inform decision making, and really create a more positive school climate and culture. And while none of those things in particular sound all that sexy, not as sexy as changing, moving a school from, say, the Milwaukee Public Schools to a new recovery school district, those really are the things at the school level that enable a student to get a consistent message, a consistent level of instruction from K through 8.
As we start to wrap up, is there a track record on this kind of effort? Do we have success stories from maybe elsewhere in the country for this kind of intervention?
It's a mixed bag. I mean, there are certainly places. The one example that you always hear is New Orleans, and they had, it was actually prior to Katrina, but really took off after Hurricane Katrina, this thing called the Recovery School District, where the lowest performing schools were placed into a state-run district. Some of them were converted to charter schools with the goal of raising student achievement, and they did have some success there. But for every success, there's also examples in the country, Tennessee being one, where we haven't seen that level of success. And I think it really boils down to the fact that, like I said earlier, a governance change in and of itself is not necessarily going to be successful. Some of the things we tried in Wisconsin, like giving a kid a voucher, well, giving a kid a voucher may improve student achievement if they're moving from a lower-performing school to a high-performing school, but that's not guaranteed. So really, the challenge and the goal needs to be creating governance frameworks that enable the things that actually impact student achievement, like high-quality instruction, to occur.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You are very welcome.
That was Michael Ford, professor in the Department of Public Administration at UW Oshkosh. He joined us to take a look at how Wisconsin might comply with the Every Student Succeeds Act, a federal education law.
Coming up, we learn about no harvest hunting. Our guest says all we need is a camera, a notebook, and our memory. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we take a look at Governor Walker's vetoes in the new state budget and what impact they could have.
First, Wisconsin has a big hunting tradition, but the majority of Wisconsinites are not hunters themselves. And our next guest says those non-hunters are missing out on a unique view of the natural world.
He says you don't need a gun or a bow to go hunting, and he's teaching a workshop called Hunting Without Harvest to encourage non-hunters to enjoy the natural world.
Ron Weber joins us now. He's from Weyerhaeuser, and he's teaching the Hunting Without Harvest workshop on Saturday, October 14th at the Aldo Leopold Center in Baraboo. Ron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob and Veronica. Good to be here.
Well, what got you interested, Ron, in this idea of hunting without harvest?
Well, I'll tell you, I've been a hunter my whole life. I mean, even before, legal hunting age, I was always, following people in my family around, with stick, a BB gun, whatever. So I've been a hunter all my life. I just a lot of people that, love the outdoors. They like nature. They like animals. But they don't get to see the views that we as hunters get to see, these just unique experiences that happen all the time when you're out hunting. It's one thing to just go walking through the woods and hope you see something. But to give yourself the best chance of having those really memorable encounters, I just think you need to be out there actively hunting and searching.
What kind of experiences have you had hunting without harvest that have stuck with you?
Oh, my God. You got a couple days? I got a whole notebook full of them. One I can think of that's, I was actually out hunting at the time. I was turkey hunting, and I was sitting along the edge of a field near a tamarack swamp, and about 20 yards off the edge of the field. And right at first light, I saw something out of the corner of my eye moving along the edge of the field, and I look, and here there's a black bear walking along. And I didn't think nothing of it, no big deal. It'll just keep walking along the edge of the field, I figured. Then all of a sudden, I catch another movement, and here there was a cub with it. And, that makes you a little bit more nervous just because a mother with a cub, you never know how they're going to react. Still, I wasn't too worried. I thought, well, she'll just keep walking. Well, lo and behold, she stops, and she actually turns and starts walking into the woods right where I'm sitting on the ground. And she got within about close to 10 feet away, about 12 feet away. And she's still walking. She's coming right at me. And at that point, I'm not really panicked. I'm not really scared. It's happening too fast. But I'm thinking, I got to do something. I got to let this animal know I'm here, but I don't want to startle it, especially with the cub. So I just started talking to it in a real calm voice, sort of like I'm just talking with you right now. And I can't remember what I said to her, but she must not have liked it because she turned around and I was surprised. She took off across that field 100 miles an hour, and she left the cub behind. A lot of times you'll hear stories, counter to that, but she actually left the cub behind, and the cub kind of wandered around for about 20 minutes, and he wandered off in her general direction, so I'm sure that they got back together. But So that kind of experience, some people might say, oh, my God, I don't want that kind of experience. But to me, it was pretty memorable.
So how would you recommend somebody get started? How do they suit up to go hunting without actually hunting?
Yeah, and I'd just like to say, these days, as a hunter, there's a lot of times I go out in the field, I don't even carry a gun or a bow with me anymore. I just go out and sit and see the sights. So I actually do quite a bit of hunting without harvest, and actually I harvest very little anymore. I guess if you're going to get started in it, the equipment end is something that can be as minimal or as, you know, you can get as fancy there as you want. All you really need to get started, I would think, is some nice camouflage clothing, warm, keep you warm and dry so that you can actually stay out in the field for, you know, an extended period of time, however long you'd want to. You're going to need a skill set, you know, and that is something that hopefully, like this workshop that I'm going to be having, you can start to learn those skills. If you don't come to the workshop, you can actually read hunting magazines and try and pick up some tips there, or talk to other people that you know that hunt. You know, whatever, you know, there's no winner or loser here. It's whatever you can get out of it. I think you're going to come out ahead. Every time you go out in that field, you're going to see something that's going to be memorable, that's going to make you want to come back, and you're going to learn a little more each time and get a little bit more confidence each time. And I think that's all that you really need to get started. One other big thing, though, that I think people need to address is feeling comfortable out in the outdoors. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of fears that are out there that people have that, you know, at some point they're going to need to address, you know, a fear of getting lost. Of fear, you know, a lot of people in the state, we have bears, we have wolves. People have to, you know, deal with that fear of, okay, there are predators out here, and how can I deal with that? And so those are just some things that I think would need to be addressed early on, but as far as getting into it, you know, just find a place where there's some animals and get some camouflage clothes and go to it.
And Ron, while we're thinking about safety, what about avoiding hunting season? Do you recommend that, you know, maybe you might go to that place where somebody might hunt, but try to make sure you're not there in season?
You know, that would be, to me, that's totally, I wouldn't necessarily have to say I recommend that, because hunting is, you know, with gun and bow, is statistically a tremendously safe sport. The number of accidents that occur in hunting are very small, and most of the accidents that do occur are either self-inflicted injuries or people hunting within their same party in close proximity having an accident with one another. It's not somebody shooting a total stranger that just happens to be out in the woods. Those incidences are very, very, you know, statistically, they just don't happen that often. So I wouldn't necessarily say you have to avoid hunting season, because actually, you know, this time of the year is a very beautiful time to be out in the woods. So I would certainly not say you have to stay away from the hunting season, but obviously you want to be safe about it. So if I'm out there, I'm going to be, you know, making sure that if I'm walking at any time that there's low light conditions, it's morning or evening, I'm going to have a flashlight and I'll have it on, to let people know I'm coming. You know, wear blaze orange if that makes you feel safer. Again, you don't necessarily have to do that, but it might be a good idea if that makes you feel safer. And especially if you know you're hunting in a public area, public hunting grounds where there might be other hunters around. If you're hunting, you know, if you're doing this on your own land or a neighbor's land and you know the people and they're not out there, I don't see any reason why they can't enjoy this any time of the year.
Talking to Ron Weber, he's teaching a Hunting Without Harvest workshop next month in Baraboo, getting some advice on getting close to nature, even if you're not a hunter this time of year. And Ron, let's talk about that workshop. I'd pictured, you know, you're sitting in a classroom all day getting a lecture, but no, it sounds like you get outside and hunker down and do some work.
Oh, yeah. there's very little indoors stuff with this. And basically, I'm going to, you know, take people through the whole steps. You know, you asked earlier, what can people do to get started in this? I'm going to take them through the whole steps from A to Z. And, you know, again, I'm going to talk about addressing those fears so they can feel comfortable, you know, going out in the woods, that they're going to get out there and they're going to get back safely. You know, just basic orienteering, using a compass and a map, using a GPS, you know, If you're not feeling safe out there, you're probably not going to have a lot of fun. So if I can get that, you know, if we can get over that hurdle right away, that's gonna start us down the road to actually hunting, you know, in a relaxed way. Then I'm gonna talk about animal tracks and sign and, you know, how to find the animals that you might want to be trying to find, because most of these animals are pretty good at staying out of our way.
And Ron, I wanted to ask before we run out of time, it sounds like the difference between thinking of this like a hunter, even if you're not literally hunting, and, you know, me just taking a stroll through the woods, it's a matter of patience. Like, you're willing to commit some time to see the things you want to see. Is that one of the more important skills?
Exactly. We live in a, you know, a 55, well, now whatever it is, 65 mile an hour world. And we walk around with devices, and our attention is very, very hard to keep for long periods of time. To hunt and to really get all the experiences that I've experienced, you have to be able to unplug yourself from that device. You have to slow down from that 55 miles an hour and have the patience to just sit. Now, again, you don't want to kill yourself. If you don't need to go out and sit out there for 10 hours, but if you could just sit for an hour quietly in the woods, you're going to see so many things. And again, it's not always just the things you're after. Those are usually, you know, if I'm out there hunting deer, I might not even see a deer, but I might see three or four other things, a beautiful sunrise, you know, a fox chasing a rabbit around. A million things that are just kind of collateral. And that's what really makes hunting, even for hunters, so exciting. It's the stuff that you never know what you're going to see. Each time out is a whole brand new experience. And, you know, it's not predictable. And that's what makes, you know, to me, that's what makes it so fun.
Ron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
That's Ron Weber. He's leading a workshop called Hunting Without Harvest at the Aldo Leopold Foundation in Baraboo next month. That's on Sunday, October 14th. We have a link on our program note at WPR.org to get more information about that.
Coming up, we'll take a look at the budget Governor Walker just signed today with a long list of vetoes. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tomorrow morning after 7, Joy Cardine and her guests look at the First Amendment and a wide variety of freedom of speech issues that have been making headlines. That's tomorrow morning after 6 on the Ideas Network.
First, Governor Scott Walker signed the biennial budget today at an elementary school in Neenah. He vetoed 99 items in that budget. The budget was originally due on his desk on July 1st, but was held up for 11 weeks.
J.R. Ross is with us now to give us a rundown. He's the editor of WispPolitics.com. J.R., welcome back.
Hey, how are you guys doing this afternoon?
Not bad. Well, let's talk about this budget signing today. What happened at the ceremony?
Governor Walker began to lay the foundation of what he's going to tout the next several weeks, if not several months, about this budget. He's going to talk about what he calls historic investment education, that property taxes on the typical Wisconsin home are going to be lower on the bill they get in 2018 than when they got in 2014, and that he's providing more opportunities from K-12 through the UW system, extending a tuition freeze. He's basically touting what he believes are the good things of this budget and beginning to message it as he works toward his reelection announcement sometime in November.
And we've been tracking the evolution of this budget for a long time here on Central Time, but the newest part is the vetoes as of today, the 99 of them. How come so many?
It's been about in line where he's been before, but a lot of it is, I think the things that really get a lot of attention are the education vetoes. So let's, you know, looking at the big picture of the budget, the $640 million roughly that would be added to K-12 spending is the centerpiece of this thing. But lawmakers wanted to do other things for education that Governor Walker was not comfortable with. One of them was we have things called low-spending districts. And what they are is you go back a couple of decades, we started going to a two-thirds funding formula for schools in Wisconsin. The state paid two-thirds overall, and the other third came from property taxes. Well, you kind of locked these districts into their spending limits per student back then, and some districts that were not spending as much got locked in, and they haven't been able to catch up. So Republicans in the Assembly particularly wanted to give them more room to collect more on property taxes to catch up. Walker wasn't comfortable with that because if you know anything about Scott Walker, is that he is almost obsessed with your property tax bill. He looked at that as a provision that would allow property taxes to go up. So he nixed it and said, look, there are some of these districts that would be affected that have gone to referendum and been denied. He doesn't want to see these districts raising more revenue from property taxes without voters having a say. So I think it's probably the biggest veto or most attention he's got so far in the vetoes is that one.
And what kind of reaction did that particular veto get, including among some fellow Republicans who might have been disappointed?
Some Republicans are very unhappy because they see that as an opportunity for these districts to catch up a little bit. In particular, like John Nygren, who is the co-chair of the Finance Committee that really shaped this budget for the legislature, he's pointed out that that would have been $90 million over 6 years for, I believe, about 200 districts, and that we're in a system where the state rates these schools, right, how they're performing. If you're rating them, you're not giving the resources that other districts are getting, how is that fair? That was one of his arguments. But again, for Walker, it's about that property tax bill. He's looking at the investment, again, which he calls historic, and K-12 going, hey, we're giving all this money, you know, that they can use that they didn't have before. I don't want to go that far on that piece.
Now, you mentioned that the governor calls the K-12 funding historic. Do you agree with that characterization?
Well, it depends who you talk to in the Capitol about that. I mean, yes, you know, the state of Wisconsin is putting more money into K-12 than it ever has. But the counter-argument has been, well, yeah, but if you go back to where we were in 2011, before Governor Walker and Republicans made these big cuts, where should we have been, you know, before that happened? And so the Democratic argument becomes, yes, it's a lot of money, but we haven't caught up to where we were before. So you're going to see a different message from Democrats about that, saying they're trying to find a way to say, yes, it's great to have this new investment in K-12 from Governor Walker, but he shortchanged us before, and we haven't caught up to where we should be or would have been if he hadn't done that 6 years ago. The question kind of becomes for Democrats, how effective can you be with that message and how receptive voters are to that? Because, again, Walker's got the easier one to make. You know, historic investment in K-12, period. That's a very short, simple, to-the-point line, right? For Democrats, is the yes, but. And it's a hard argument to make sometimes with people with their attention spans.
Talking to J.R. Ross right now, editor of WisPolitics.com, as we take a look at the state budget signed today by the governor, and also looking now at the vetoes, 99 vetoes there. Just talked a little bit about education. And, J.R., the governor also vetoed a state tax credit that helps restore historic buildings. What's the story behind that one?
Basically, if you go back to when this was created, it seems like, okay, here's an option to kind of help spur development in historic areas of Wisconsin, especially in urban areas, to get things rolling. The problem became it was so popular, it took off and was much more expensive than they thought it was going to be. Walker sought to rein that in with his original budget. Lawmakers had a different approach. This one brings it back to being a more strict limit on how much can go out the door. Because remember, when the tax credit is given out for a project, that's lost revenue for the state. It's less money for schools, for Medicaid, for governor operations, on down the line. So we kind of put a little bit of a pulled it back a little bit to keep that money in check.
What's your impact of the financial impact of that one?
Not really the exact numbers off my head, but it's not going to be as generous as it was before. Now the question kind of becomes, okay, what does this mean for these projects? One, what comes first, the project or the tax credit? The tax credit induce behavior or did it reward behavior? What happens in the next 2 years? Will there be people who say, well, it's still a good deal, we'll do it anyway, or will there be fewer projects? That's kind of the unknown of these things. What's the incentive? Taking away some of the incentive, is still enough out there to get people to do these projects in largely urban areas.
Well, let's talk about the prevailing wage. That had some action from the governor in this budget. What's the latest?
So Governor Walker proposed originally in his budget to repeal the prevailing wage on state projects. Now, go back 2 years ago, the state already repealed it on local projects, on schools, local governments, that kind of thing. This is a provision to extend that to state projects. In the budget that lawmakers passed, there was an effective date, I believe, of September 1st of 2018. There were three Republicans in the state Senate who were unhappy with some provisions in the budget and said they couldn't vote for this budget unless they got some concessions. Robin Voss, the Assembly Speaker, said he's not going to take up the budget again. Once they passed out of his house, he was done with it. So those three said, okay, Governor, we need these vetoes to, you know, win our support. And without at least two of them, they couldn't pass the budget. They get these vetoes in. One of them is this veto from Walker that takes that implementation date from September 1st of 2018 and basically is as soon as the budget takes effect, which is really after the governor signs it, now that goes away. That means that there will not be any more of a setting of a wage for these projects, which proponents say saves the state money on this work, and opponents say means that these construction jobs aren't paying as much and aren't providing enough family-supporting wages as they were before.
And how do you see that changing things for Wisconsin workers? Obviously, it moves the timetable up quite a bit, but big picture.
Big picture, we're still kind of figuring out the full impact of what that meant for local projects. Now, there's some numbers out there, but it's only a year and a half, 2 years old, so it's kind of hard to know exactly a good feel of what big picture. But Democrats argue we're already seeing lower wages for people on these projects. Proponents can say, hey, we're saving money on them. It may take a while to get the full feel of what's going on, but there's some evidence on both sides of their arguments.
Now, another action item from the governor's veto pen. The governor vetoed the funding to fill 5 vacant positions on the State Elections Commission. What's happening with that?
If I remember this correctly, those positions were already, I think, vacant. There was some federal money for that went away. They wanted to restore funding for it. His argument is they can do the work with what they've got. So that was part of that rub, I remember correctly about that one.
And we're talking right now to J.R. Ross from WixPolitics.com about the biennial budget that Governor Walker just signed today, also looking at the long list of vetoes.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the state budget, especially in the big areas like transportation and education? They've been talking about funding for local schools. How is your local school doing when it comes to the state budget? What would you like to see, if anything, change? Are you a local school administrator? How does all of this affect you? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Also, how do you think it's going to affect the race for governor coming up next year? Call in again, 800-642-1234.
We'll continue the conversation and get to your calls in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up our conversation now with J.R. Ross from WisPolitics about the budget that Governor Walker just signed into law today, including 99 vetoes.
You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the news on the prevailing wage law, on education funding, transportation funding, and how do you see it all fitting into the race for governor and the state legislature next year? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org.
And we go to our callers now. We have Kyle with us first from Muskego. Kyle, hi.
Hi. My comment was on prevailing wage, particularly in construction, and how repealing prevailing wage isn't going to save taxpayers any money, or how I don't see how it could save any taxpayers any money. And the reason why is in most construction, new or older, the labor only averages about 12-13% of the budget. But of that 12-13% of the budget, maybe only 6% or less of that goes towards the actual workers. And let me explain why. I worked in construction. I was union. I made $23 an hour as an apprentice, but I was put on jobs with non-union workers who were making $16 an hour on average without, even though they had more years of experience because they weren't union. However, the company that was doing the construction was billing the customer $125 per guy per hour that they were there, regardless of whether they were union or non-union or their years of experience. And that's kind of how construction labor is budgeted.
Kyle, thanks a lot for that. And got some experience there in the construction industry. J.R. Kyle saying that due to the complicated way that the labor payment goes and then the billing goes, it's not going to save that much money, the prevailing wage veto.
During this debate on the budget, I apologize for which state, but Democrats during the debate brought up one state where it did away with prevailing wage. Again, I'm sorry I'm blanking on it, but said they quoted a leader in that state saying it didn't really save any money. So that was part of their argument. But again, with this experience in Wisconsin, I haven't got a good feel about it yet, and it could take a while to play out. But they did make that point during the debate that it was, in their minds, it was going to be a big money saver for Wisconsin.
All right, Kyle, well, thank you for calling in with your perspective. I appreciate that. And let's go to Pam now in Northwest Wisconsin. Pam, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to ask a guest, sorry, I forgot your name, but
JR.
With the educational budget, could you please explain to the listeners what portion of that educational money is actually going to the voucher system, which in many cases goes to private parochial schools? And I've had many conversations with people who have no idea that taxpayer money is going to religious schools.
And Pam, thank you for the call. I don't know if JR, if you have those numbers in your back pocket, but this has been a flashpoint in Wisconsin.
I don't have the exact number off the top of my head, but this has been one of the things that Republicans try to address, especially with the Milwaukee program, is what the people have called the Milwaukee flaw, in that property taxpayers are picking up the cost, essentially. So they've been working on that to try and address that. But, yes, there's definitely a chunk of that money that is going to choice schools, because voucher students, as part of state law now, if schools get a per-pupil increase in funding, same happens with the voucher amount. So that is going to be a flashpoint. Now, nothing happened with this budget is that right now in Milwaukee and Racine, so there are three separate voucher programs. There's Milwaukee, which is the oldest one, Racine, and then statewide. Milwaukee and Racine have an income limit of 300% of the federal poverty level. The statewide program is being bumped up to 220%, so you're going to have to see more kids eligible from a higher income level family. There's still a cap on how many kids can enroll each year from different schools, but there's a continued expansion of this program that's been going on Republicans, and I believe it's 1% more of that cap every year until it goes away after 10 years.
Okay, Pam, well, thank you for that, and that's a conversation that will continue to play out here in Wisconsin. And, JR, another look at a veto quickly before we see if we have time for another caller. Some change in oversight for for-profit colleges.
Mm-hmm. So Education Board goes away, but the Walker administration argues there's still going to be oversight from the state. Part of what Governor Walker has tried to do, and whether you agree with him or not, is in his mind streamline government. He sees that as redundancy, that board versus having the state, the administration is a redundancy. Obviously, if you're not a fan of Scott Walker, you don't trust his administration to properly have oversight of those for-profit colleges. So you see this as a weakening of the oversight system. And, that's one of the arguments that you're going to hear as this goes forward.
And let's take another quick comment from Cindy in Appleton. Cindy, hi.
Hello. I think this budget is a disaster. It's borrowing $400 million. We're going to be giving $300 billion to the Taiwanese con job. And there is nothing in this budget, and has not been since Walker came in, that addresses public transportation. We need some kind of a train system in this state to keep up with the rest of the states. And this is something that just never gets addressed with the Republican budgets, public transportation.
Cindy, thank you so much for that. JR, you were starting to say something there.
Even Republicans who want to put a positive spin on this will tell you that the big failure of this budget was transportation. And they'll also tell you it's queued up to be a problem going forward, depending on what happens next fall. And why I say that is 2 years ago, there was some chafing by Republican lawmakers because they wanted to see if there's a way to raise revenues for roads, because we're borrowing more money every budget to pay for road projects, and that borrowing is eating up more and more of the money coming into the transportation fund. I believe by the second year of this budget, if I got my numbers right, like 22 cents of every dollar that we take in from your gas tax, registration fee, that kind of stuff, is going just to pay off the interest on our borrowing. That's not really sustainable in some people's minds. So 2 years ago, there was chafing about that. They borrowed some more money and pushed it off, saying, okay, maybe in two more years, we'll figure something out. This budget, Governor Walker laid a marker early on. Well, okay, he would veto a gas tax hike unless there was an offsetting tax cut, right? But as he got close to the budget, he moved those goalposts and said, no gas tax hike, registration fee, period. So they ended up in a situation where, again, they borrowed more money, they created this new fee on hybrid electric cars, but there's no long-term fix. And probably a lot of us will be honest about that there's no long-term fix. The issue becomes, all right, 2018, if Governor Walker's reelected, all right, let's just assume that...
We've got about 5 seconds left, JR.
In 2 years from now, it's the same dynamic with Republican lawmakers and Governor Walker, and Walker saying he's not going to raise the stuff because he's going to run for president again someday. He won't run for president, having some gas tax hike. So now
it'll be back to the starting block. JR, we got to leave it there. Thank you for joining us.
Anytime. Take care.
That was J.R. Ross, editor of WishPolitics.com, joining us to look at Governor Walker's long list of vetoes and the state budget.
Hundreds of visitors from around the world, many from Asia, gathered in Wausau this last weekend. As Glenn Moberg reports, they were there to celebrate and experience a unique and highly prized product, Wisconsin ginseng.
Men in garish red and gold costumes snake through throngs of people in downtown Wausau, opening the International Wisconsin Ginseng Festival with a traditional Chinese lion dance. People in Asia have used the medicinal root for thousands of years. Paul Sue has been growing it in central Wisconsin for four decades.
This is the first international event for ginseng, and we got people coming in from Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, China, all the Chinatowns in USA and also Canada.
Paul's son, Will Sue, now vice president of the family business, said American ginseng is as different from Oriental varieties as yin and yang.
American ginseng is yin or cooling. It's a tonic meant to alleviate stress and promote overall health. Asian ginseng, which is another species, is yang, or hot, stimulating, more like caffeine.
American ginseng is highly prized in Asia. 95% of the American crop is grown in central Wisconsin. It's a $20 million a year business.
It helps the circulation.
Vendors at the festival were hawking ginseng capsules, ginseng tea, ginseng lotion and lip balm, ginseng ice cream, and locally brewed ginseng beer.
Welcome to Wisconsin. If you are not from here, we are so delighted to have you here.
Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish helped organize the festival. One local politician, State Senator Jerry Petruski, is a former ginseng farmer.
I'm a believer. I take it every day.
Petruski is sponsoring a bill that would make ginseng the official Wisconsin herb.
Fairly well accepted that Wisconsin grows the best ginseng in the world.
The festival was the brainchild of Lisa Berry of the Convention and Visitors Bureau.
Pretty much everybody here has some story, like my grandpa farmed ginseng or my grandma worked on a ginseng farm.
Berry got lots of people across Marathon County involved. There were ginseng exhibits at museums and bookstores. Restaurants had ginseng menus. Signs were printed in Mandarin.
And we're the first place in Wisconsin to have bilingual signage in English and Chinese.
Directing international visitors to the Fromm Brothers historic site, where a pioneering family first discovered how to cultivate wild ginseng, and to Wausau's Monk Botanical Gardens, where Nathan Bashinsky and other local chefs held ginseng cooking demonstrations.
Just some homemade chicken broth with some ginger, lemongrass, obviously ginseng, shallot, thyme, some garlic.
Naksum Bae came here with 15 people from Chicago, all speaking Korean.
Ginseng is very famous in my country. We really enjoyed the ginseng cooking and fresh ginseng and samples.
Buses took visitors to ginseng farms where they could dig their own roots under the canopies that provide shade for the notoriously hard-to-grow plants. Pat Chapinski came from Delafield.
And you're given a fork to dig it so that you don't break off all the fibrous material.
Zhang Lin Chia and his wife Ninsong Yang came all the way from Beijing, China, accompanied by their daughter-in-law, Lian Zhu of Green Bay.
This is their first time actually seeing how ginseng is grown, because we always see the final products, you know, the dried ginseng roots in grocery stores and medicine stores.
Others came from China for business. Qinghua Zhang is a developer and ginseng trader from Guangzhou in South China. He spoke through a translator.
He sells the American ginseng in China. Wisconsin ginseng is the best quality in the whole world, and that's the reason bring him to Wausau.
The central Wisconsin crop has seen its ups and downs because of price fluctuation and competition from Canada and China. But organizers here hope the ginseng business gets a boost from the weekend the world came to Wausau. Glenn Moberg, Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, our guest business expert and coach shares advice about how to be happy at work.
We take stock of the biggest Wisconsin news, from the passage of the state budget to the State of Education address.
And for Food Friday, we get recipes for cooking with a classic Wisconsin ingredient, beer. We'll take a look at the different flavor profiles and what to cook them with.
That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Tomorrow morning after 8, Joy and her guests look at the top stories in state and national politics on this edition of The Week in Review. This week, healthcare, again, the Hillary Clinton memoir, and the state budget. That's tomorrow morning after 8 here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then the Foxconn deal might have hit a constitutional snag. We'll get the latest from the WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White after the news. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.